From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Rich and powerful players from around the globe have gathered this week in Davos, Switzerland, where the annual World Economic Forum is underway. It's a time to network, strategize, and think big. But some key world leaders are missing from this year's event because of troubles at home. President Trump canceled the U.S. delegation's trip amid the partial government shutdown. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did address the conference by satellite today. He said he expects progress with nuclear negotiations with North Korea by the end of next month. Other major leaders who are no-shows in Davos: Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May, she's dealing with Brexit, and French President Emmanuel Macron, who's contending with the yellow vests protests. Tom Keane is in Davos. He is editor-at-large for Bloomberg TV and Radio. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So how does the absence of these three heavyweights matter in what talked about and what gets done in Davos?
It's every year somebody shows up. This is my 15th year. I have the clearest memory of Sarkozy wandering in with an entourage of 100. Maybe it was 10 years ago, and on and on. And, of course, President Xi 2 years ago of China. And, of course, President Trump with an extraordinary moment last year. And as you say, Lisa, it's all evaporated.
But that sounds almost like nothing's getting done. But doesn't this give a chance for the non-English-speaking countries to come to the fore because they don't have to share the spotlight so much?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. And a theme will be found. But what's fascinating is really for the first time with the new populism worldwide, the politicians are off their game and the bankers off of a huge year last year and an okay year this year. The financiers, the investors, the bankers seem to have a little more spring in their step than the politicians and the government officials who are really beleaguered again by this global populism.
Okay, I want to find out more about the bankers and financiers and what they are doing there. But does the government shutdown, especially since, as you mentioned, Donald Trump came in last year with a keynote address saying the U.S. is open for business, and we should note that the U.S. government was closed at that point in a far shorter shutdown the same time last year. This year, the shutdown is 32 days. What is being said about that? How is that being reflected in Davos?
It's fascinating. There's a distraction of Brexit, but on the shutdown, there's almost a curiosity to it. There's less discussion of it than there is. There's more angst about it. I spoke in London a week ago with a Democrat operative, and he made very clear to me he's looking for a six-month shutdown. No one here is looking for that.
The angst that you're talking about, is that because of the worldwide implication of the shutdown, or is that because it seems like the United States in some way doesn't have its act together?
Two things. It's definitely the follow-on to global GDP and the world order and all that. But I'll tell you, Arne Sorensen of Marriott was piercing about the effect of the shutdown. Obviously, he's talking his book of the large Marriott hotel company, but he was piercing about the effect of the shutdown adjacent to his many immigrant employees.
What did he say?
He said there's real strain just now beginning to click in. I would suggest, Lisa, that's one paycheck out, two paychecks out. Can you imagine if the Marriott extended family, very largely immigrants and immigrant families, can you imagine if they get out to three or four paychecks?
So you said because some of these global leaders are not there, that the bankers and financiers are coming to the fore. What are they talking about?
Yes. Well, it's very interesting. They're coming to the fore, and they're being a little coy. Last year, they were riding high. There was almost a palpable giddiness. It's different this year. The giddiness is not there. They're talking about rationalizations. It's a banker aware of the December ugliness, the Q4 ugliness. They are more optimistic right now, but by no means are they stepping with the step that they had 12 months ago.
Tom, we know that things get done at Davos. I wonder to what extent things get done that are tangible and actionable versus people working on their slalom. Because as you well know, the rap about Davos is that most people are kind of enjoying the ski slopes.
I really take issue with that. When I came here, there was a little bit of the heyday of the let's go snowboarding, skiing down the hill. Of course, nobody here would snowboard. That would be beneath them. But within that, Davos has become equivalent, Lisa, to a plumber's convention in Las Vegas. The executives are here to meet other executives. It's a rule of thumb over 4 days. Now, with that said, they're coming in and they're working, but I'm not sure how many are staying for a full 4 days.
And why is that?
They got to get back to their offices. They've got to get back in London to Brexit. They've got to get back in America to the shutdown. And we haven't talked about the other turmoil out there, including in France. France perkles up here much more than I expected.
This has to do with the yellow vest protests from public workers there. By the way, this is a Swiss ski town. There is a lot of snow, but I understand this year an unnatural amount of snow. How bad is it?
It's the worst it's ever been, going back to, I believe, 1961 or 1951, and it is snowy.
It is snowy. Tom Keene, editor-at-large for Bloomberg TV and Radio, thank you.
Lisa, thank you so much.
Well, let's turn to domestic politics and brace yourself, because we're going to the last unresolved midterm election contest, the 9th Congressional District in North Carolina. You remember, this is where an associate of the Republican candidate Mark Harris was accused of collecting mail-in ballots from voters and promising to fill them in, which is illegal. The Republican narrowly beat the Democratic candidate, Dan McCready, but he wasn't seated so that these accusations could be sorted out. Well, this morning, the Republican, Mark Harris, asked a judge to certify his 905-vote lead over the Democrat, Dan McCready, despite those questions about vote tampering. Oh, and despite the recent dissolution of the state's Board of Elections. Joining us is WUNC politics reporter Rusty Jacobs. Rusty, this is a big saga.
It is ongoing, ever complicated. As you said, Mark Harris's legal team has filed this motion. It's a very specific legal question. Can the court intervene in what today's judge actually termed a dramatic intervention, a dramatic move, and intervene and order the State Board of Elections executive director to certify that 905-vote victory by Republican Mark Harris over Democrat Dan McCready?
I want to back up, because we mentioned the election board. The Republican Party had reshuffled the board, and that was declared unconstitutional back in October. But the judges that made that declaration then said that the investigation into vote tampering could continue. And then in December, they dissolved the board. A new board is starting at the end of this month, I think January 31st. So what is Mark Harris, the Republican, arguing?
He's arguing that the board acted in a partisan way and is essentially trying to delay his certification and being seated as a congressman representing the 9th District. The attorney general, the deputy attorney general representing the State Board of Elections today, pointed out that two of the Republicans on what was then a bipartisan board, it was 9 members, 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, 1 unaffiliated, 2 of the Republicans joined the final vote not to certify the Harris victory. So that kind of cuts into the argument that this is a partisan effort to keep Mark Harris from taking his seat.
And what are lawyers for McCready saying, the Democrat?
That's right. The judge allowed Dan McCready's attorney, Mark Elias, to intervene in this case. It is essentially a case between Mark Harris, the Republican, and the State Board of Elections, but McCready is intervening, and he's essentially saying that the court doesn't have jurisdiction. There is an argument by Mark Harris's team that there are statutory timelines in place when a formal petition is filed. And they're saying, actually, that McCready never filed a formal petition and that all that's happening is there is a State Board of Elections investigation that doesn't form a petition. So by now, under the statutory framework, certification should have been issued. But Dan McCready's attorney is saying the Mark Harris's team wants to prematurely end a fact-finding adjudicatory process that will play out once a new board is appointed after this law takes effect January 31st, and the investigation and the evidentiary hearing can be held.
Well, you know, even if the judges there and the courts there were leaning towards saying to Mark Harris, you know, you're right, this is taking too long, you should be seated. Democrats this month took control of the House, and they're saying they won't seat Harris without an investigation into these allegations, and that they may even have their own investigation despite what a state elections board, the newly formed one at the end of the month, does. So can they do that? Can they, if the state decides one thing, can they stop it?
Well, that is a key argument of the Attorney General representing the State Board of Elections, saying, look, this is all going to end up being moot anyway, because the U.S. House, under its own, is going to require a complete investigation before seating Mark Harris. In fact, just before all this happened, before Mark Harris filed his motion of what they call the writ of mandamus, asking the court to order the certification, they said the U.S. House reached out to the State Board of Elections and said, please preserve all your investigative materials, all your records, turn them over to us. So, yes, that is an argument that Dan McCready and that the State Board of Elections is making, that even if the court wanted to intervene, the U.S. House is not going to seat Mark Harris. That basically the new board is going to be appointed within 10 days. This investigative and evidentiary hearing can be held. It should be played out.
Rusty Jacobs there, a WNC politics reporter. Thank you for jumping out of the court on your cell phone for us, Rusty. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We know there are children who, at a very young age, feel they were born into the wrong body. They change their names and how they dress and publicly identify with the gender they're more comfortable with. It's called a social transition because these kids have yet to make any changes to their bodies. They may never. But there's much disagreement about how young is too young for kids to make that social transition. John Brooks of KQED reports.
There's a fierce debate roiling the world of transgender research. And at its heart, it's about children like Gracie. I met Gracie at Rainbow Day Camp in El Cerrito, California, on the San Francisco Bay. It was water day.
I got wet, and I loved it. So fun.
Gracie's got a rainbow swimsuit and blonde ponytail. She throws her body onto a makeshift water slide, then pops back up.
I need to do that again.
Rainbow Day Camp was created specifically for kids who are transgender. Gracie, who is now 7, socially transitioned to being a girl when she was 4. She still remembers what it felt like back then, when people thought she was a boy.
It was not right to me, and I didn't want people to say that, but they said it. And it hurt in my feelings a lot.
And what's it like now?
Feels happy to me.
From hurt to happy. In healthcare, that's a success. And some gender experts point to stories like this one as proof that even young kids like Gracie will thrive after social transitioning. When Gracie transitioned, she got to pick a new name and wear girls' clothing in public. Family and friends began using she and her instead of he and his. Gracie, once viewed as a boy, was reintroduced to the world as a girl, all before age 5.
So we have seen some kids as young as 2 whose parents are bringing them in because they're beginning to say, me not boy, me girl.
Diane Aronsaft is the director of mental health at the Child and Adolescent Gender Clinic at UC San Francisco. She's a leading proponent of the idea that parents shouldn't wait if their kids are ready to socially transition. She thinks delaying can be harmful.
Because what we are seeing in the children who are held back is children who are anxious, depressed, because they are not being affirmed in the gender they're trying to tell everybody they are.
Transgender adults attempt suicide at much higher rates than average. So Aronsaft says,
why would we deny for the vast majority of kids something that is basically a suicide prevention?
At the UCSF Gender Clinic, there's no rule that kids have to reach a certain age before starting a social transition. And that's where it gets controversial.
We are certainly accused of being either the Wild Wild West or even forcing kids into transgender identities.
When Gracie wanted to transition, her parents did wonder if it was too early. Here's her mom, Molly.
We said, what if we do this? What if we let our son walk into the world in a dress with fairy wings and crowns and high heels, and then he changes his mind?
That's a valid concern, according to Dr. Jack Drescher. He's a psychiatrist in New York who studied the treatment of transgender kids. He supports social transitioning, but he has doubts about doing it so young. Here is why.
The research literature currently shows that most transgender children who showed up at gender clinics over the last 30 years did not grow up to be transgender. They grew up to be gay.
There have been studies tracking transgender kids over time. They all found at least two-thirds of the kids later switched back to their original gender. But these days, lots of experts dismiss those studies, including Diane Arensaft at UCSF. The problem is that many of the studies are old, from a time gender roles were more rigid. Most of the studies included kids who were considered transgender at the time, but wouldn't be today. Now we would just call those kids gender nonconforming.
Under that umbrella falls a whole group of quote-unquote effeminate boys, girly boys. So they were never going to be transgender in the first place.
You might ask, what's the big deal if a kid wants to switch genders again later? What would be the harm? After all, these young kids don't undergo any physical changes. Jack Drescher says switching back would be a big deal and could be really stressful.
Helping a child and the family do a social transition in one direction requires a lot of resources to help the transition. Why would it not require a similar amount of resources if the child changes their mind?
There's scarcely any research on so-called detransitioning. One study did look at a handful of transgender girls who decided to switch back to their birth gender when they were teens. They had a very hard time emotionally making the switch a second time. Gracie's mom, Molly, knows all about the research, but she has no doubt that socially transitioning Gracie at age 4 was the right thing to do, because Gracie had been talking about it for years.
As soon as she could tell us, it was, I'm a girl, I'm a sister, I'm a daughter, I'm that girl on that show, I'm that girl in that book.
Her parents had really tried to steer Gracie in another direction. When she wanted dolls, they gave her toy trucks and pirate ships. But it was taking a toll.
Like, you never got to see that sort of, like, sparkle. And I got to a point where I was like, I can't do it anymore. I need to see my child light up.
The current clinical guidelines are cautious about social transitioning for kids. But a committee of transgender experts is now working on the next version. What comes out of those meetings could mean either more or fewer children publicly changing their gender. For Here and Now, I'm John Brooks.
And now to the town of Braddock, Pennsylvania. They're holding open auditions, that's right, auditions, a week from today, to find a new mayor. It's just temporary until a new mayor is elected in 2020. Still mayor for a year, and it's a big seat left vacant by John Fetterman, a powerhouse mayor who served for 13 years and is now Pennsylvania's lieutenant governor. Braddock Borough Council President Tina Doucet joins us. And Tina, you know, headline writers are having a field day with this. They're calling it Braddock Idol. Why an audition?
Well, we could have just selected someone. According to Pennsylvania State Borough Code and the law, we did not have to put it out for applicants or ask for people that were interested. We could have picked someone and allowed them to sit in that position for a year until the voting process was complete. But we really wanted to make sure that there was transparency and that the community was involved, because John truly elevated the role of mayor in our little borough. So we chose to go about it differently.
Well, and some may remember John Fetterman, Mayor Fetterman, when he went on the Colbert Report and asked for a Subway sandwich shop to come to his town because he didn't have enough places for people to sit down and eat. He got more than that Subway shop. He's got software and tech companies to move into your town to, you know, try to help it spring back from its more robust times when the steel industry was flourishing. But who are you hearing from? What are some of the applicants saying? And by the way, they have to be residents. But what are some of them saying are their qualifications?
Well, it's a variety of folks have applied. You know, people who have no idea about how local government functions, as well as individuals that are business-minded and want to do things to build the business community back up. And we're expecting to get someone that's engaged, that is community-centered. So it's promising at this point. And I don't know how many people we'll end up with, but I'm hopeful that on the 29th, we'll be able to select someone that cares about Braddock, is engaged. Will we get another, you know, John Fetterman, another Harvard grad. I doubt that. Mm-hmm. But I think we're going to get someone that is very focused and is energized about making Braddock a better place to live, work, and play.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We are at a time in our country's history where there's a debate about whether or not somebody having had experience in, you know, the world of politics, whether that's a good thing or not. Are you looking for somebody who's had political experience, or are you looking for someone who, you know, maybe hasn't had any and might be a bit of a flamethrower? And either way, are you concerned? I mean, if you get someone who's never done anything like this before, it could go either way.
I don't think that matters as much as it does that the individual have, I guess, what we would call intellectual curiosity. So if they have a willingness to learn, to understand local government, and to grow in that capacity, I think we'll have a wonderful mayoral appointment, and hopefully they will seek the office permanently.
By the way, these auditions on the 29th, will they be, I mean, not dancing, certainly, but will they be making a pitch?
They will. So all the applicants have registered with the borough office. We will be able to assess and make sure that they've voted in the borough of Braddock and pull up that information. They've also submitted their resume and a letter of interest. And during that public meeting, they will, for 5 minutes, tell everyone, council and all those in attendance, why they want to be the mayor of the borough of Braddock.
Quite a local moment. Tina Doucet, the council president of the Braddock Borough, Braddock, Pennsylvania, former steel town that's seen, you know, quite a bit of a comeback under its previous mayor, now looking for a new one through audition. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Communities across the country have been grappling with outbreaks of overdoses from the synthetic drug known as K2, or spice. It can cause people to hallucinate, lose consciousness, even die. Remember last summer, a dangerous batch of K2 led to more than 100 overdoses in Connecticut over just 2 days? In Washington, D.C., emergency officials responded to almost 400 people in 1 week. Well, now the district is trying to combat use of the drug by sending out health workers to areas where K2 use is highest. From member station WAMU, LEU reports.
On a rainy afternoon, Asada Tafari and her teammates huddle at the corner of P Street in North Capitol in Washington. P Street, she says, is a known hotspot.
The plan is to reach out to everyone that we see in this corridor, talk to them about where to get help, the effects of K2, and prevention.
Tafari is a community outreach specialist with the district's Department of Behavioral Health. She's part of a small team that goes out daily to help connect people to services such as drug treatment, healthcare, and housing. The district has 3 teams specifically for K2.
Can we?
The 5 workers start walking up North Capitol Street. Some of them carry leaflets, others little kits with lip balm and hand sanitizer. As they pass by a Chinese food shop, a group of 5 or 6 people gathered up ahead starts to leave quickly.
That was a group of dealers, so known K2 dealers. So as you can see, they dispersed when we came up because that's usually what they do.
But those aren't who Tafari and the teams are focused on anyway. So they keep walking up the block. At the bus stop, they find a man smoking a K2 cigarette. They stop to speak with him, but don't linger.
I mean, they always use in front of us. And in a way, I think that's kind of a good thing because they know that we're not affiliated with the police.
The goal, she says, is to build trust with those they meet. Outreach worker Andre Simpson-Vaughn says the drug has mostly been affecting those who are chronically homeless.
You know, they're just out here, so they figure, why not? K2 is a very inexpensive drug. So the whole purpose of doing the engagement especially to try to get them housed and whatnot, is to get them through, because it gets discouraging. You have these wait times for housing, and so you want to bridge that gap with them in the meantime.
K2 can be addictive, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And during certain weeks in 2018, the D.C. outreach team saw overdoses daily. Last year, officials say there have been more than 3,400 overdose cases in the district linked to K2. Six people have died. Tanya Royster, former director of D.C.'s Department of Behavioral Health, says it's partly because the drug is so unpredictable.
So what is available on the street on any given day can be much more harmful physiologically than just the day before.
Though K2 is sometimes called synthetic marijuana, it's not really weed at all. It's a bunch of herbs or potpourri that has chemicals sprayed onto it, and the formulas are changing all the time. Back near P Street, Asada Tafari says that's why it's hard to know what to expect when she approaches people.
Kind of scary, though, sometimes, because you don't know how a person's going to react if they're using K2. It could be catatonic, it could be violent, it could be angry. They could just pass out immediately, you never know.
Regardless, the district's behavioral health teams continue to be out daily. Tafari says she runs into the same people over and over again. She says as a result of their efforts, some people have gone to treatment. But not all.
In this area, I would say most of the people we run into just aren't ready.
But the hope is that if or when they are, they'll know where to go. For Here and Now, I'm Ellie Yu.
It's tough to be an independent commercial fisherman, and regulations that are designed to manage fish populations are part of the reason. The government has imposed a quota system. Fishermen have to pay to catch certain kinds of fish, like cod. Cod is deemed to be in low supply, so fishermen are only allowed to catch a limited amount of it. They can pay to lease someone else's quotas so they can catch more, but that's expensive and makes it harder to turn a profit. One fisherman in Maine is trying to fish more sustainably and make a living doing it. His name is Tim Ryder. Ryder is the founder of New England Fishmongers. We caught up with him in Littleton, New Hampshire. He was visiting one of his customers, Chef Adam Aldrin, at the Beale House Inn. That is part of Tim Ryder's mission, to sell directly to the chef.
We own a business where we sell our fish directly to our customers, restaurants and consumers alike. It's my whole life of making this work, and what we've seen is when you cut out a lot of this, you know, tap dancing in between seafood, we're getting our fish directly to our customers 24 to 48 hours after they're caught. It's a fresh fish, the freshest fish they've ever seen. It's been showcased in Food & Wine magazine. Our customers have supported us and love the fresh fish, and it really has really given me the fuel, my fire, to keep doing this. The people believe in what we're doing. The fish is the best they ever had.
So, okay, I want to talk about how you managed to catch the best fish that some of these high-end restaurants ever had. I know that you hand-deliver the fish. As you said, you don't go to auction. You kind of get around a middleman. You bring the fish directly into the kitchen. You have caught that fish.
Yeah, the last stretch of days, I just fished 12 out of 13 days before we had this weather. And what we basically do is we take the best care of the fish on the boat that we can. We bleed our fish, we brine our fish, we make sure they're packed in ice. We work diligently at the quality of our fish. You know, the average fish that you go and eat at an average seafood restaurant has been around for 10 days and traveled 7,000 miles. We beat that by about 99.9%.
So you're kind of like the dairy farmer who delivers his own cow's milk directly to the house. When you go out every day, you have your boat, 36-foot boat called the Finlander, right?
We have Finlander 1, a 36-footer, and Finlander 2, a 47-foot LeBlanc.
And when you go out, how far out do you go?
It varies. We're scalloping. We're only 2 miles off the beach, but when we're hook fishing for pollock, we're 65 to 70 miles offshore. A little dicier on the 65-mile offshore ride.
How come dicier?
The weather. You know, you're in harm's way, and if anything happens, you're a lot further from home. And most people say we're crazy for taking a 36-foot boat 65 miles offshore in January, and they might be correct about that. But one of the reasons we do that is because we can't afford to catch cod. So we pass over fish that we could catch to catch other fish, because the folks of the sector system of management has made us target species like offshore to stay away from cod. And it makes us risk our lives to do something that we normally wouldn't do.
So you're catching cusk and haddock and dogfish and monkfish, and as you said, pollock as well. But you mentioned something, when you get the fish in, and this is rod and reel, when you lure the fish in, supposedly you take extra good care of it. And what is usually done, and what do you do differently?
Well, rod and reel, and we trawl for flounders and monkfish. You don't catch monkfish on rod and reel. But with all the fish, we bleed our fish and we brine our fish.
What does the bleeding part mean?
Yeah, you hit the fish in a certain spot right in the aorta, and the fish pumps out all the blood. So you have no discoloration in the fillet. If you take a bled fish versus a non-bled fish, the color of the fillet is enormously different, right? It's very similar to hunters bleed their deer. It's essentially what we're doing with the fish. After the animal's done pumping the blood, we immerge it in a seawater and ice mixture to shock chill it and brine it and then layer it on ice. So we take the best quality of our seafood as, you know, fish as we possibly can, even scalloping right now. Like, obviously we're not bleeding every scallop we catch, but we're going through our scallops and we're rinsing them as quickly as we can in seawater, packing them on ice, really making sure we don't toss them around, bruise them, break the pieces up, and then gently getting them off the boat packaged to our customers as quick as possible.
So the result is, and I should say the bleeding part is a little bit unsettling to hear, but I suppose the fish are going to be eaten anyway. But the fact is that you're treating them in a better way. So this is what you have to do to try and beat the big guys, or at least beat the regulations, because you're not going to have much greater quantity. So you have to rely on quality. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, believe it or not, quantity, we still have to wholesale some of our fish out. But we take a lot of pride in what we do, and what one of the benefits that the culinary world has seen is a shelf life. It holds up tremendously well. So he can serve our fish buy our fish on Wednesday and serve it on Saturday, where the fish that's been around for 2 weeks that hasn't been treated that well, he's already starting to throw out. And it's allowed us to, we've had to do it to make it work, because when we tried to wholesale a lot of our fish, that our quality isn't, that no one cares. You know, and we get the same price as strip fish when we go to these places. And that's really hard because we aren't working on massive volumes. We do catch enough fish to service a lot more restaurants. It's obviously my sales pitch, you know. And that was our goal. And our goal was also to, with the business, is if I ever outgrew what I was catching, to be able to help other fishermen get the best price that are doing the same things as us, because others are looking at us for an answer. We saw historically the worst prices in New England ground fishing at the fish that had to go to auction this year that anyone's seen in 20 years. And local day fishermen, family fishermen paid the price severely, us included. And that's pretty shameful that, you know, where people are saying this, you know, there's not enough fish or this and that, or we got to go to farm raised fish and this, all these different programs that they have. But we have all this beautiful fish coming off the day fleet that we're basically throwing out or selling for pennies on a dollar. People can't even make a living. So one of the ways that we've defeated that, or trying to defeat that, is getting that fish as quickly as possible to our customers so they see the benefits of fresh fish. And the other benefit of this too is, you know, Adam and I were talking about this here, is that the local fisherman is talking. I've talked to Chef Adam on the boat a couple times over the past couple weeks while we're fishing. So these guys are connected with the product, like they're connected with the farmer that raises the produce and the beef and everything. They know who we are, and they can call us and ask us about what we're catching.
You mean he'll ask you when you're out on the boat what kind of fish you're catching, and then he can plan his menu accordingly?
He will, yeah. And a lot of these guys will call and see what we're doing and what we're catching, and it's focusing on seasonality. We catch a lot of flounders on Finlander too in the spring, so I'm hoping we see better people grabbing more of the flounders. And obviously pollock this time of year in Finlander 1, we catch a lot of pollock. We catch a lot of haddock in the spring. And we've seen a lot of people adapt to what we're catching. People that were traditionally didn't want to touch pollock, you know, I've kind of had to force it on them and say, try this, please try this. And they've come back and said, it's great.
When you presented to them the pollock, wouldn't you say try it, meaning make it, or do you make something for them and say, here's a forkful?
I think a lot of our customers at our retail, I'd say, take this piece of pollock and take it home and try it and tell me what you think, because they're very reluctant. And they will take it home, and then they usually come back and say, wow, it was tremendously good.
And how much more can you charge for that than, say, they pay at the grocery store?
Believe it or not, our price off the boat are as competitive as the grocery store with the direct model, because there's not that many people making as much money in the in-between steps. So our price to sell Adam cod in Littleton, New Hampshire off the boat is actually more affordable than the bigger companies out here, which is crazy. And that's for direct, you know, fish right off our boats. So we do better by doing that, but there's not as much money made in the middle. And that's what's allowed us to really stay in business. If we didn't have this end of the business, we would be out of business because it didn't work wholesaling fish. I mean, as many trips that I've done with the beautiful hook and line pollock that you see in Food and Wine magazine, where we came in with 2,000 pounds of those fish and left with not even enough money to cover the fuel. We've literally wholesaled those fish out for 30 to 40 cents a pound and made nothing for fish that's considered some of the best fish in the country. So it's a direct approach. Is people think it's only for the rich and wealthy. That is actually very off from the truth completely. So we're pretty competitive to what's going on with grocery stores or bigger chains or anything like that. And it's just the direct way that we do it.
Business is good.
Business is good. Yes, business has been the retail end of the business has been enormous. We have a huge following. And we have more and more folks saying, we love what you're doing. And it's an old school way of doing business I'm really proud of. It's a handshake and a thank you to our customers from the people that do the job. And that's the fundamentals of what we've tried to do here. Know your fishermen, and they know. I believe 100% in what we're doing.
Tim Ryder, thank you so much.
Thank all of you guys for supporting us out there very much.
Question, is Facebook going to have to pay for Cambridge Analytica? Or maybe the question is, how much will it pay? Let's back up. The Federal Trade Commission is reportedly nearing the end of its investigation into whether Facebook violated privacy rules when political consulting firm Cambridge Analytica, shaped in part by alt-right consultant Steve Bannon, obtained data from tens of millions of Facebook users without their permission. When the investigation wraps up, it could result in the largest fine imposed on a tech company by U.S. regulators to date. So let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor covering social media at Recode. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Robin.
So the FTC has been, you know, looking at Facebook for about 10 months now since this Cambridge Analytica scandal broke. What is the thinking that they're expected to issue a result? What are people seeing?
Well, there were reports at the end of the last week that the commissioners of the FTC met recently, I believe it was in mid-December, to discuss imposing this massive fine on Facebook, and that they are close to getting to the end of this investigation. Of course, the FTC is part of the federal government, which is currently shut down, so there are some questions about how soon this could actually happen.
Yeah, there are reports, though, that some of the commissioners have been seen in their closed, shut-down offices, so that's been a tea leaf people are looking at. But what is, you know, Facebook guilty of here? Let's go back a little bit. Didn't they have a consent decree from 2011 that required them to get permission from users of plans to share data?
That's exactly right. So if we rewind, I guess it was 8 years at this point, to 2011, Facebook had agreed to basically increase the restrictions that they would place on themselves and to get more permission from users about what data was collected and, more importantly, what data was shared with other people. And they promised the FTC that they would, you know, get that permission from users before they made changes to their policies. And as we've learned with the Cambridge Analytica situation, it does not seem as though Facebook necessarily followed that agreement that it came to, which is what spurred this FTC investigation. And, you know, if Facebook is found to have violated that agreement from 2011, that's when we're going to see the fine implemented.
Yeah. And as you said, reported, expected to be a record fine. Currently, the most the FTC has fined a tech company is Google in 2012, also for privacy violations. That was $22.5 million, which doesn't even sound like a lot anymore, but especially when it comes to a tech company. How much would it have to be painful to Facebook?
Yeah, that kind of fine anywhere in that ballpark would not be painful, at least financially. Facebook is going to bring in probably well north of $50 billion in revenue in 2018. And so, you know, even a fine of $1 billion, which would be a massive jump over that $22 million that Google got fined a few years ago, would only be 2% of Facebook's revenue, right? So there's not going to be a huge financial penalty here, or at least least it seems hard to imagine the FTC could fine Facebook enough for it to hurt financially. I think more importantly is, will this change any of the rules and laws around what Facebook can collect and how it uses it? Because that could hurt the business moving forward into the future.
Yeah. What about other actions? There was a class action lawsuit filed by lawyers in the UK and the US against Facebook for the Cambridge Analytica scandal. It's just one of many lawsuits Facebook is facing. So might there be legal trouble beyond the FTC?
There's definitely some potential for legal trouble. I think the FTC investigation is probably the most serious because not only does it come with this risk of financial penalty, but it does pose the risk of, again, creating more regulation around the company. What we've seen from some of these other lawsuits, the damage is less about a financial thing. It's more about information about Facebook leaking out. So when we saw a few months ago about all these emails leaking out of Facebook that showed some of their privacy practices, that was because those emails were part of a lawsuit that had been filed and then were made public. And so what we've learned from those is more about the inner workings of the company, and that's been damaging to its reputation more so than, you know, how it actually operates.
Is Facebook saying anything about this?
No, right now Facebook has been pretty much declining comment, other than back in March when this became known that the FTC publicly said that it was investigating the company. Facebook said, hey, we're participating and, we're happy to answer any questions they may have. Otherwise, they've been really silent.
What's the sense here, Kurt? I mean, these might become very micro issues and they look very macro right now, like, oh, this is a big swath of thought. But maybe they're just little micro things, and maybe overall people, might ultimately give up in thinking that they can defend privacy. What's your sense?
I think this has been the last 2 years have really been a chance for reflection on how we got here, and that a lot of these tech companies and consumers have realized that the notion of online privacy was very much ignored for the very beginning of kind of the social media craze. And no one really thought much about putting their photos and their address and, their contact list online. And now it's coming back not only to bite, consumers who feel like they've been betrayed, but it's coming back to bite these companies that took advantage of it. And so I'm not sure that, you take Facebook, a $50 billion revenue company, and say, all of a sudden you're going to be squashed into oblivion. But I do think that there's going to be some real pain when people start to wise up and leave those types of services.
You think? Kurt Wagner, senior editor for social media at Recode. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.